This is the On Humans podcast with your host, Ilari Mäkelä. And today's episode is about what is perhaps the biggest mystery in and around science and philosophy today. This is the so-called hard problem of consciousness. In short, how is it that a world seemingly made up of three-dimensional bits lacking feeling or meaning can combine to create something so utterly different? A creature like you or me, whose life is full of feeling and meaning. Now, there are many people who think that there is no way, even in principle, that we could have a satisfactory explanation of this jump. I've interviewed two people who more or less do believe that. These are episodes 17 with Bernardo Kastrup and 30 with Donald Hoffman. Feel free to check them out if you're interested. But today, I'll try to give a voice for the other side. My guest is Eva Jablonka. She's a really renowned evolutionary biologist, famous for her work around epigenetic inheritance. And that's a fascinating topic, and there will be a future episode on that very topic, but today we're not going to talk about epigenetics. We are going to talk about the broad field where Jablonka works, which is evolution. Jablonka has recently co-authored two very interesting books on the topic, and the question that I'm going to pose Jablonka is whether evolution can explain the origins of feeling and meaning. Jablonka says yes, and we start discussing first how she thinks this happens, when she thinks it happened, which creatures she thinks are conscious, why she thinks that robots and AI do not qualify as such creatures, and finally, whether this evolutionary theory of hers can solve the philosophical problem, or whether it's simply a scientific theory of getting from something simple to something more complicated, but not an explanation of why there was something in the first place. I leave it for you to judge, but I do hope that you enjoy and learn something new from this conversation. If you do, please consider showing some support. The simplest thing is just to subscribe and give a 5-star rating if you think that I deserve it. If you are a regular listener and want to make sure that the show continues, you can join the group of wonderful people who support me financially on patreon.com/onhumans. This support is really vital for me. At the moment, it helps me cover the fixed cost of the podcast, without which I really couldn't make this happen. But I really do need more income in the long run to make this a sustainable use of my time. So the website again is patreon.com/onhumans. Now let's get back to today's show. So here is Eva Jablonka on whether evolution can explain the origin of consciousness. Professor Eva Jablonka, welcome to On Humans.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me.
One of the very tricky things when talking about consciousness is that it can mean so many different things to different people, right? Your book with Simona Ginsberg is titled The Evolution of the Sensitive Soul, which is a beautiful phrase. And it comes from Aristotle, right?
Yeah.
Maybe Aristotle can help us to triangulate what exactly you mean by consciousness. So this is a kind of level two soul in Aristotle's categories, right? Where level one is just basically being alive, being able to grow.
Yeah, yeah. He calls it the nutritive and sometimes the reproductive soul.
And the level three would be rationality. This is something that perhaps is associated more with abstract reasoning, language, symbolic thought. Right. And the sensitive soul is kind of in the middle. What is the sensitive soul?
So the sensitive soul is the ability to have desires, to have aversions, and to have a kind of mental experiences, like you perceive things and you feel. So you don't just react. When you're thinking about living organisms, you can think about them as very, very complex kind of entities. But nevertheless, you don't have to think, although some people do think, that a bacterium actually feels anything. It is a very, very complicated entity, and it reacts to the environment in a very plastic and very adaptive way, but you don't have to think that it actually has subjective experiences. So for Aristotle and for us, a sensitive soul is basically having some kind of experiencing, some kind of subjective experiencing, and some kind of mentality. People in philosophy call it phenomenal consciousness.
There is a really nice passage from Jonathan Burge, who reviewed your book, where he explained it this way. I'm curious to hear your reaction. Would you agree that this is the way to describe the problem? Birch writes, quote, "If I throw a ball across a field, there are facts about the physical processes going on as the ball flies through the air, but there is nothing it feels like from the ball's point of view. Now, imagine a dog chasing the ball. There will again be facts about the physical processes going on as it sprints across the grass, but this time there will also be something it feels like from the dog's point of view. To be conscious in the most basic sense is to be like the dog rather than the ball." Would you agree?
Yes, I agree. It's a nice way of putting it. And when you think about it, we usually think about ourselves, about humans, because we're humans. And when we think about consciousness, we also think about thinking and about believing and about having all kinds of doubting as part of our consciousness. Now, this is kind of reflective consciousness.
This would be the level 3, the rational soul for Aristotle.
You know, we reflect about these things. But a lot of the time we don't. We just see, we just feel. We don't think about what we see or feel. And so when Aristotle is talking about the sensitive soul, it is this very direct, very basic kind of feelings and perceptions that he's focusing on, and desires. So if we're thinking in terms of values, of what is the value for Ethereum, so you would say, well, it's survival and reproduction, right? This is what is guiding the life of this organism and its evolution. When you're thinking about conscious organism, minimally conscious organism, sensitive soul kind of organism, is driving them. Yes, of course, the common denominator, the constraint on every living organism is survival and reproduction. You always have this constraint, but it's only a constraint. Now what is driving the animal are desires, are aversions. And these desires and aversions are based on feelings, what you like, what you don't like, what makes you afraid, pains, joys, satisfaction, all kinds of things like this. And when we're thinking about joys and pains and things like that, they are related to some things in the world.
They are about something. We fear something or we see something.
Exactly. So there must be something that we perceive in some way, in addition to our perception of our own bodies. The feeling of the body, even though we are so used to it that we usually are not aware that we're feeling it. We only feel it when something happens. For example, when we lose our balance or when we have to dance. I mean, then there is a kind of flow. But usually this flow of our bodies is something that we are not very aware of.
I'm completely with you. I personally am very sympathetic to the view that basically a lot of what feeling means is feeling, sensing literally our own body, about how, and this is what Antonio Damasio talks about when he says that feelings are basically, it's the brain catching up on how is life doing in the body.
Yes, representing the body all the time vis-a-vis the world. And so, you know, it's not only this, or it's not just the world, it's not just the body, it's always the interaction between them. But so this is basically the sensitive soul, and then you have, and with humans you have you have reflection, you have the second order reflection, and here we have something very, very interesting about humans, and that's why we think that Aristotle was right in thinking that it is a qualitative. There is a qualitative difference between humans and other animals, and because now we have values which are symbolic values, like justice, like the good, the beautiful.
Not just finding something beautiful, but talking about the beautiful.
The beautiful, the good, justice, the three big values, you know. And in order to achieve them, we need another value which is related to them, which is freedom. And so this big four is what is driving us as human beings, which is, you know, this is not what is driving a mouse or a dog.
The big four being?
The good, the true, the beautiful, and freedom, which is allowing us to follow these values.
Very interesting, very interesting. Yeah, and I think this is quite a nice way to set the problem, because the origin of life is a very, very difficult scientific question, but most people think that it is a scientific question. We can solve it. The evolution of human language, symbolic thought, leaving aside the question of are humans actually alone in this, I think it's irrelevant to this more important discussion, which is that we think, most of us think, that there is a scientific story that can be explained scientifically. But it's this state in between, the sensitive soul, which many say that in some sense will escape science forever. And when people say that there is a hard problem of consciousness, they typically, this is what they talk about. And you think that we can have a scientific theory about the evolution of feelings, the sensitive soul. And would it be right to, in a kind of very quick summary, to say that you think that it evolved because it allows us to learn in a more complex way?
I think that putting it in this way is a bit misleading.
Good. Then we have something to talk about. So correct me.
It's not that we became conscious because we need to learn better. It is that learning in a particular way, in this open-ended, generative, representational way, which we called unlimited associative learning, requires a system which, when you look at it, you realize that it must be a conscious system in biology, in biological organisms. So, for example, you will not say that you are alive in order to do better some chemical reactions, right?
Yes.
What I would say is that certain coupling of chemical reactions, by definition, gives rise to something that we characterize as alive. And it is the same thing here. You can think about unlimited associative level learning in animals without thinking necessarily about consciousness, right? You can, but once you sort of realize what it takes to do this, you realize that all the properties, all the characteristics that we attribute to consciousness must be in place in order for this kind of learning to be there.
So in a way, it's not that we first evolve consciousness so that we can learn better. It's that if we are evolving to learn in a more flexible way, when in this kind of almost unlimited way, but we'll get to what that means in a moment, then we need a certain amount of building blocks. And when those building blocks are in place, consciousness emerges as if automatically.
Yes, it's there. Then the system is conscious in the same way that the coupling of certain complex chemical reactions is creating a system that we call alive.
You talk about unlimited associative learning, which is a technical word, and before we lose our listeners with jargon, let's unpack this. I've seen you once divide it into four capacities, that if the creature is able to do all of these four things, it has this kind of new way of learning, new flexible way of learning. And by the way, it ends up also being conscious. I think maybe we could do this four one by one.
So the fourth thing is kind of complex discrimination learning. Let me give you an example. So you have a peahen and she's looking at peacocks with different tails. And there are lots of information that is coming to her senses, right? And they are very similar, the tails. And yet there are differences between them. You know, some colors are a little bit different. Some are brighter, some are less bright, or some are more, there are more contrast. There may be slight differences in symmetry. There is a lot of information. And the peahen is able to see the tail as a totality on the one hand, and on the other hand, to also analyze it into parts and compare it with other tails. So the ability both to see things as a whole and to analyze the whole into parts and to infer and that this tail is more exciting than that tail. Yes. So discrimination learning means that you are able to integrate a lot of information in a way that is both unifying but also allows you to do analysis. So this is the first thing. And a lot of animals can do it, surprisingly.
What kind of animals cannot do it?
So, for example, I don't think worms, annelid worms, it can do it. Bees can do it,
but worms cannot, based on our current data.
Okay. Based on what we know. We're always very cautious about it because we know so very little.
Yeah. And so basically the idea is that there can be a worm that sees but is and is able to react to, for example, a change in light, but is not able to create a composite of when this kind of light on the left side and that kind of light on the right side are together, they create a pattern.
Yeah, maybe it can see even things as a whole, right? But it cannot discriminate them when you sort of change them in a subtle way and you change their organization. It cannot discriminate, cannot do this complex discrimination learning. It can do a lot. It can learn a lot. I mean, worms are wonderful, but there are things they can't do. This is one thing. The other thing is what is called in psychology trace conditioning. And this means that you have a predictive cue, that let's say you have some kind of noise, and after that noise comes a nice food. But there is a gap, a time gap between the noise and the food. And an animal can learn that the noise predicts food, and it can prepare physiologically and behaviorally to eat this food. Okay? This is what Pavlov did with his dogs. Now, the fact that there is a gap and you can hold it in your mind and know that in spite of the fact that there is no overlap between the predict and the food, means that you can hold things in your mind, that there is some kind of temporal integration there. And this is very, very important because this kind of temporal integration is part of our feeling of time for us.
Of the passage of time.
Yes, this is about the perception of time as something that has a duration.
This is a wonderful example of, I mean, we're only on the second one of the list of four, but I think that's a wonderful example of how we can start seeing the links to consciousness in that in the first case, we go from a creature that's just reacting to certain kind of patterns of light, being able to see a whole, and now we get the kind of experience of time.
Yeah, but think about it. Think about the creature, the peahen, who is seeing the tail. It's not just integrating a lot of information, it's mapping it, right? Representation is not just, it's not simple integration.
So for the peahen to learn that this is the peacock I want to mate with, that is a peacock I don't want to mate with, the peahen has to have a map of both of these two tails. And so we get intentionality, the aboutness in consciousness, right?
Exactly. And then we have the third thing, which is very important. And this is the ability to change your opinion about things. So think about this peahen, for example. She's looking at it and she decides this is good. But then she sees another one, another male. It's really, really nice. And she changes her mind. And this is one example, but there are many, many examples of things that in one circumstances they're good, in another one they're bad, in a third one they're neutral. And, you know, and it all depends on context. So the ability to change your evaluations of complex stimuli, the ability to make trade-offs, to prioritize some things, this is better than this in this circumstances.
Yeah. And that requires there to be a map of the peacock's tail, the map of the other peacock's tail, but also a map of the surroundings, reading the room, so to speak.
It requires a very flexible value system. Emotions and feelings are expressions of such values, right? So this is the third aspect, this very flexible. It's not something we always respond like this. If you always respond like this, that's a reflex.
Yes, so if the peahen is kind of genetically programmed to every time they see red and green together, they go and mate, that would be a reflex. You don't need consciousness. You don't need this kind of stuff.
No. And then the fourth thing is that you learn on the basis of what you have learned already. So you learn one thing, for example, you learn that a particular smell is, you pass near a restaurant and you smell something nice and you say, oh, there's food there, I'd like to do that. And then you also learn that if you have money, you can go to this restaurant and buy this food. You don't need to, you have already learned that the sign is there, and you know, you now can use another thing in order to achieve whatever it is that you want. I'll give you another example from birds. For example, some birds, when they see fire, they know that a lot of insects will come out, right? And then they learn that smoke predicts fire.
Okay. And smoke predicts insects.
And therefore, smoke predicts insects. Exactly.
And I guess is that where the term unlimited learning comes from, is that when once you're able to learn on top of previous learning, there is no theoretical limit.
Not just this, the ability to be so generative, to compare a lot of things to a lot of other things. Think about how many things can be compared in the world and how many combinations of things can happen. The ability to learn, even though there is a gap, gives you a huge ability to learn a lot of things that otherwise you wouldn't be able to learn, right? The ability to be flexible about your reactions for good and bad evaluations gives you a huge range of possible reactions. So that's why we called it unlimited.
Could you give an example of a creature that is able to learn some things but does not have this kind of unlimited associated learning? Because this all sounds, I think most people would be like, oh, this sounds very good, of course, but can everyone do that to some extent? And of course, not every creature can. So what kind of things, what would learning look like before the emergence of this kind of unlimited associative learning?
So for example, a lot of animals cannot do the stress conditioning, cannot learn when there is a gap. They can't. A lot of worms, they can't do it. Yes, they can't do complex discrimination learning.
So what can they do if they, what would be a simple discrimination learning as an example?
It's big or small or something like this, or, you know, it's very, very simple things. So they, and even if they can see things and react to them or perceive things and react to them, they cannot compare them to each other. They cannot do, say, this is better than that. They can't do it. And there are many animals that have a very limited ability to change their opinion, so to speak, about something, whether it's good or bad. There are animals that will always prefer to go to a dark place rather than to a lighted place. And there are animals that cannot really learn on the basis of learning very much.
They couldn't use money because they wouldn't realize that money is something that gets you the thing that you want. They just go for what they want.
Yeah. And when you sort of analyze these four capacities that we have been talking about, and you see what is behind them, that you need intentionality. So intentionality means mapping, that you need a sense of some kind of duration, that you need to see things as wholes and also as parts and combine to react to whole part relations, that you can categorize and you can transfer from one modality to the other. You see all these things and you say, well, if we met something like that on another planet, we would assume that it is minimally conscious. This is why we thought that it is a good marker, because it, when you think about the list or what we call the consensus list of what people think, what would characterize a creature that is conscious, people, I'm talking about philosophers, about cognitive psychologists, or biologists, people think about unity. People think about global accessibility. People think about intentionality. People think about temporal depth. People think also about the self of sense, differentiating yourself from the environment and having a point of view. And in fact, when you are looking at the world and reacting to the world in a goal-directed manner, then you always do it from a point of view, a certain point of view.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit more about that? Where does the sense of self come from? I mean, I understand that, for example, I represent what's coming from me versus the outside world. So that if I tickle myself, it doesn't tickle. Whereas somebody else tickles me, it does tickle. And a lot of animals have, right, this kind of mapping of what's inside, what's outside, and it does make sense that that helps in learning. I cannot learn to move forward after this sound if I don't map move forward my body somewhere in my brain. But how does reflecting back on those four capacities, how does the sense of self emerge from that? I can understand that it's a good idea to have a sense of self for flexible learning, but how does it relate to those four things we discussed?
This is something that is that comes earlier. Even a worm, if it is crawling on the ground, it feels the ground, right? But it is making itself feel the ground. But if suddenly something touches her, she will react very differently, because it is not she, the worm, that is making the sensory experience happen. And therefore, it will freeze. Now, with the worm is a reflex. But if you are thinking about an animal that is able to learn, there will be a lot of distinctions between what comes from its own learned experiences and what comes from the world. And also, you know, you have to have the same kind of perspective when you are looking at different things. Otherwise, you can't really compare them. You're all the time in some kind of a different world. The world has to be consistent. And since we have a body and we have senses and all these animals that have this unlimited associative learning have a head and a brain in this head, and senses which are concentrated there, it comes from these senses which are concentrated in the head in one place where the point of view, which give the animal the point of view.
Good. So unlimited associative learning would then, in summary, can we think about it as moving away from being able to react to reflexively and maybe even learn to couple things with each other in a very simple way where, yes, maybe there is an individual light or dark flash or a loud sound or a not loud sound, etc. And there might be some simple couplings, loud sound bad, light good. And when we move from that kind of very simple phase to being able to see, it's a hissing sound. Oh, and it's part of that wiggly thing that is a snake. And because I know the snake is a bad thing, now I also know that the hissing sound is a bad thing. The hissing sound can come first and the biting can come 10 seconds later. All of these things end up obviously being a good thing for some organisms, for their survival. And what you're saying is that you kind of get the whole package of what philosophers analyze consciousness as being almost entailed by them.
Exactly. It is entailed by it. This is exactly it. And the point is that if you accept this, then you can see, okay, unlimited associative learning is a very complex behavioral strategy, but it's something traceable, something I can test in the world. I can see if an animal can do it or can't do it. I can trace its evolutionary history.
We might be wrong about worms not being able to do it, but it's a scientific question.
I might be wrong, yes, of course. But nevertheless, I have some kind of tool that I work with. And I said, okay, now I have something I can work with. And now I can follow the evolution of this thing. And by implication, also the evolution of consciousness, minimal consciousness.
Fascinating.
Okay. And this is the way that we're thinking. And this is why, for me, if you're, of course, you have to accept this is a good marker. And you know what? If somebody has a better one, welcome to the club. That's fine. But I think one of the things that we think, and this is something that is very, very specific to our kind of point of view, is that unlike other people who say, look, consciousness and cognition, they're completely different things. Here, look, we have robots. They can learn. They can do this. They can do this. Yes, of course they can.
Can they do unlimited associative learning?
They can't do it. They can beat you in chess, in Go, and all kinds of other things. It's a very unidimensional kind of thing. Now, if there will be robots that would be, and you know, I have a whole paper that is analyzing what we actually need, what kind of robots we need in order to have this kind of complexity that associative learning requires. And it's very likely that we need to make them from soft materials because of the plasticity inherent in materials. Materials are not something we can forget about. It's not, we have to think about ontogeny. What kind of ontogeny?
So what kind of development? What kind of childhood, so to speak?
Exactly. What kind of development? Yes. How they develop? We have to think about a lot of things. Once you unpack it, you start unpacking the actual things that go into this learning in animals. What makes them so enormously plastic, so enormously able to learn in this kind of incredibly complex way. I mean, no robot can do what a simple worm can do. A worm can do millions of things. It can run away from a predator and can hide here, and it can eat, and it can mate, and it can do a lot of things. The point is that it can do a lot of different things in order to live and survive and reproduce. Huge amount of things. If you want to be able to respond to many things, maybe you need to have this kind of softness, the soft kind of materials. I'm not saying that you cannot overcome this, but at the moment, the way that I'm thinking about, that one can think about it, you have to have an incredible kind of responsiveness. Now, this responsiveness comes with a price. it is easy to destroy the system. The system is vulnerable. But if you don't have this vulnerability, if you are made of iron, it's only very extreme things that will make a difference to you. If you want very subtle things to make difference to you, well, you have to be able to respond to very, very subtle things. How do you do it? We do it. Biological organisms do it by being very, very flexible, water-based kind of systems. Now, maybe one day we will be able also to have a system that is made of, water, of some kind of hard materials, that will be able also, we'll find some tricks that will enable it to be very, very flexible. But I bet that this flexibility will come with some kind of pride, with some kind of vulnerabilities.
Okay, let's leave robots aside then and see, without going too deep into all the complicated words around different phyla, etc., in natural history, you think that consciousness has evolved not once, but three times, right?
Probably three, yeah.
How and when?
Let's go back to this unlimited associative learning. If you accept it's a good marker, then you can look at what kind of nervous systems you need in order to implement it. Now, once you know what kind of nervous system you need to implement it, what kind of bits and pieces in the nervous system would do the job to produce this, and you know in which animals you found this unlimited associative learning, and now you look at their brains, then you can also say, I now know which bits and pieces and what kind of bits and pieces in the brain I have to look at. Let's look at the fossil record. Now, in the fossil record, fortunately for us, we can find also traces of brains. So we can look, see when this kind of brains first appeared. And when we do that, we see that the kind of brains that can support unlimited assertive learning appeared at first in the Cumbrian. This is 542 million years ago.
And it's a fascinating period.
It's a very fascinating period because it is the big boom of evolution. That's why it's called the Cumbrian explosion. It's when most of the phyla that we know of appeared, all animal phyla.
Yeah, am I right that there really hasn't been a new body plan created after the Cambrian explosion? So we are all basically just tweaks on the body plans that were created then.
Well, big tweaks sometimes.
Big tweaks, but yeah. I mean, you write fantastically. You talk about this idea that it was in the Cambrian that we get not once but three times the evolution of conscious organisms.
The Cumbrian twice, and then 250 million years later, we see it in the coleoid cephalopods, which is the squid,
okay,
the cuttlefish, and the octopus.
Okay, and the two times in the Cambrian are the vertebrates and
the arthropods.
Vertebrates like us and arthropods like insects, bees, etc.
Yeah, like insects, like crabs, like shrimps.
Okay. You write really beautifully in your book. You write, quote, "It was in the Cambrian we suggest that the great war of nature began to involve suffering, the subjective experience of anguish and pain. It eventually led, somewhat paradoxically, not only to dreaming and imaginative animals, but even to animals that collectively build utopias of a life without suffering," unquote. It's a beautiful passage.
Thank you.
In the quote, you say the war of nature. Am I right that this refers to the idea that it was before Cambrian, there really were no predators, at least on a large scale? So most organisms were pretty much just floating about there, doing their own business.
The war of nature came from Darwin. He used this phrase. Okay. That's why we use it.
Okay.
I think that in the Ediacaran, which is the period before the Cumbrian, I think there were already some jellyfish and creatures like this and ctenophores, and they're predators. Mm. They're nasty predators. So there was some predation there, and of course, it was not a kind of paradise because there were always parasites in this world.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's move to philosophy then. So I think that we've done a fair, hopefully we've done enough of a good job that listeners who are still with us have now a pretty good idea. And I have a better idea than I had before this discussion about what exactly your theory is, the scientific theory. Now, the question, of course, is, does this solve the philosophical problem? The philosophical problem, as we discussed earlier, being that some people say that once we get to feeling the sensitive soul, and we've started with basic scientific worldview, and then we end up with the sensitive soul, there's a leap that happens there that we really have a very tough time in justifying. This is the hard problem of consciousness. I could hear someone who hears your story and understands the theory still disagree with the idea that this has solved anything philosophically. To say that, well, look, to get anywhere like unlimited associative learning, for that to make sense, you have to start talking about the good and the bad. What's good for the organism? Oh, now the organism can learn much better what is good for it. You have to talk about things like goals of the organism. And that language is not a language which fits very well with a basic physicalist worldview. And so that there is this jump that has happened along the way. And that jump has happened much before we get to unlimited associative learning. So yes, it is a wonderful theory to how we get from, how do we get to this kind of consciousness that we have. But the very fundamental leap has happened already before it, and it's been kind of smuggled into the theory. What do you think about that response?
I think the argument doesn't hold water. And the reason it doesn't hold water is that this means that when you have a system that can survive and reproduce, is alive in this in the biological sense, then you have things that are good for life, bad for life. This is why in our book, we went very slowly from very simple reflexes, which you don't need any kind of mentality for them, right, which are good for the organism or bad for the organism, into limited associative learning, where you can learn, but still you don't have all this coupling of the right kind of systems that will give you an inner kind of life, a subjectivity. Although there is something, you have internal states, right? But there is no subjectivity there. And we say that the subjectivity is the result of the evolution of learning that started as completely non-mental. You don't assume any kind of mentality there. It's good or bad from an outside point of view, from the survival and reproduction point of view. And once you sort of begin to evolve this strategy, it entails this kind of internal feelings. So we don't assume these feelings a priori.
No, but I think that someone can say that there's a lot of complicated things happening, but it's kind of a magic trick because we start with something that could be described purely chemically. And we end up with something that cannot be described purely chemically because it has to be described with teleological terms. This is good for it. This is bad for the thing.
It's the same with life. You know, you start with chemistry and you end up with something like a bacterium or something simpler than a bacterium. So what? I mean, you know, how does chemistry become biology, you can ask. This is what people ask in the middle of, in the beginning of the 20th century, end of the, and during the 19th century. How does chemistry become biology? How does life appear? There was no life before. There was complex chemistry, right? So again, there is no magic trick there. It's the coming together under certain circumstances. And when they were coupled in a particular way, as the system that emerged was a system that we call alive, in the same, exactly in the same way we're talking about.
But I think that you're not giving quite enough credit to how revolutionary, in a way, your philosophy is, if it's accepted, because you do talk about teleology, the fact that organisms have goals or functions or end goals. You talk about genuine part of nature. But a lot of biologists, a lot of philosophers of biology say that this is an Aristotelian mistake, that really what we have is we have something that looks like purposes, but they're not really deep down there. And so would you be willing to say that we can solve the hard problem of consciousness, but we can only solve it if we move towards a more Aristotelian worldview where goals are genuinely part of living things?
There is a huge amount of nonsense written about teleology. And the problem was that teleology was described in terms of external teleology of design, of God, and so on and so forth. So people were very, very allergic to it, or vital force. something that is outside the organism, something that is not internal teleology, but is external to it, or is added to something, to the mechanism. It's not part of the mechanism, but something that you add, a new force, vital force, for example, or a designer, a god. So people were very allergic to it. And the word teleology became a dirty word. But of course there is, when you read Aristotle and you see what he's talking about, he's talking about living beings fulfilling the kind of value and having the goal of surviving and reproducing are goals that are internal to the processes of life as we define it, right? Part of the definition of life is the self-maintenance, metabolism. This is part of the very definition of life, part of our characterization of life. So you don't have to import a kind of external teleology in order to explain this. And now, when you are coming to conscious animals, yes, there is already the kind of goal directedness is different, because now organisms actually want things. The bacterium doesn't want things. It reacts to all kinds of things as if it wants. But the dog wants to drink. It is hungry. Yes. And it is doing things in order to satisfy this felt needs. Of course it does. And this is a very big transition. Here we have genuine goals. They're goals in a very different sense from the goals of the bacterium. Nevertheless, this system that has these goals has evolved. And what we did, or tried to do, is to explain how it evolved. There was no magic there.
I think everybody would agree that you have done a very good job at explaining how we get from there to here. But the question is, what is there? So I can imagine, for example, a panpsychist. So panpsychism being the theory that there is a certain kind of very, very rough elemental consciousness that pervades the whole universe. I could see a panpsychist saying that you've done an amazing job and that I've learned a lot from your book. Because the problem for us panpsychists is, how can we explain, this person would say, how can we explain how there are things that are obviously not conscious in a very interesting, complicated way? And there are things like dogs and humans, etc. And you've done a wonderful job at explaining how we get from what you actually at one point in your book called the white noise, the kind of very unstructured white noise before the unlimited associative learning, to the operas and the symphonies that we can experience now. Okay, that's a wonderful job. However, the white noise is what we were talking about. There is something before this process happens, which is the building block of this complicated form of consciousness.
I understand. I want to divide my answer to you into two parts. First thing is that I don't think that the white noise, as we called it, this turbulence, this internal turbulence, is something that is equivalent to consciousness. I don't know what it means when people say that a bacterium is conscious. This is the negative side of what I want to say. Now I want to say something positive. I think that when we are thinking about living organisms, we miss something. Living organisms are not inert things. They are not machines. They are not even soft machines. And thinking about them as machines is a mistake, I think. There is something about living that we miss. There's and kind of, we called it in a recent paper that when we were thinking about it, Simona and I, when we were thinking about it, we called it vivaciousness. There is some kind of inwardness, vivaciousness. It's internal to the organism. It allows this incredible plasticity that we have, and it allows the responsiveness, the incredible responsiveness that we have. And that's why I'm somewhat sympathetic to the biopsychist. I'm not a biopsychist. I really don't think that the plants are, for example, are feeling in the sense that I can understand this feeling. But I do feel very strongly that we miss concepts, that we miss something in the characterization of living beings like plants, or even like bacteria or paramecium. There's something there that we're missing. It's not consciousness as I understand it. It's not like they're happy or not happy. I can't say that about them. But there's something there that we're missing, probably. And I think it is a very, very interesting kind of... it's very interesting to investigate That's why the road to this. Now, what we said about unlimited associative learning is that it is a marker, it's an evolutionary marker. When it's there, you know that the transition to consciousness, minimal consciousness, has gone to completion. It's completed. But what happens before it's completed? Right. This is very interesting. What does it mean to say that it's completed? So I think this would be, it's a very interesting kind of something that we should be thinking about quite a lot. Sometimes I feel uncomfortable when people are comparing living organisms to machines, even to soft machines, soft robots or something like that. I think I sinned once or twice doing this in the past, but I think it's a mistake.
So would it be right to think then about the hard problem of consciousness from your point of view, that you don't think that it is a hard problem for science, but you do think that it is a hard problem if we don't take biology seriously enough, if we don't almost take Aristotle seriously enough, if we keep wanting to jump from physics to consciousness, we will not be able to do it. But if we think more about life and we pause with this almost mysterious element of life that you describe with the vivaciousness, that then we can actually tackle, biology can tackle the problem, but that we have to acknowledge that we really need biology. We can't just do it from physics.
No, the only conscious organisms that we know of are biological organisms at the moment. I would think that since this is the situation, it is a really, rather good idea to start to do something to learn biology and to understand why is it that only biological systems, as far as we know, are conscious. Why? Let's see what the fact that it is a biological organism does, and why is it that it is that we see consciousness only in living organisms. And I'm not saying that we cannot one day construct a robot made of very different materials which is conscious, but it will be based on what we understand from biology.
We have gone a little bit over time already. Is there something that during this conversation, you felt like was an important aspect of the book that we have not touched upon that you would like to still discuss?
Do you know that we wrote a little book, a picture book?
I do, and I did not. I wasn't able to get my hands on it, unfortunately. So I haven't read this. I've read the long one, not the short one.
Well, the short one is different a little bit. The way that it is constructed is there is one page of text and the picture, text, picture, text, picture. And it's sometimes more than one page, but not in many cases. And it always, and the picture is sort of not a diagram ever, but a real picture with color and everything. This allows the reader to sort of use his or her own imagination, because there is no one interpretation to any of these pictures. And also the texts, in the text, we're not offering a lot of answers. We're offering a lot of questions. This is how it's built. But one of the things that is there in this book that is more there than it was in the Sensitive Soul is that there is more about humans, about human consciousness, and there is more about where human consciousness can go in the future. How it can further evolve.
How can it?
Well, I think that the fact that people are using all kinds of devices that can extend their perception and also connect them with other people in different ways can change their feelings. I mean, feelings and thinking are not completely separate. They can be separate in humans. They can be decoupled. We are the only animal that can decouple feelings and thinking in such an extreme way. The only animal, and this is why we're so good at things that's so horrible in other ways. And I think that this consciousness will be very, very different. So we're looking at people who are at consciousness under extreme conditions of pathological conditions, madness, of certain types of madness, religious experiences and things like this, We're looking at drugs. We're looking also, because we can extend and change our consciousness with drugs and other devices, you know, chips or something like this.
How will these devices work?
I can implant something in your brain and implant something in my brain, and we can communicate.
How soon do you think this will be possible?
50 years.
And will it be like two people talking, but much faster, or will we merge into one?
I don't know. That's one of the questions that we ask. But also virtual realities and things like this. I mean, what is happening now? I mean, if you're looking at what's going on, I mean, AI is going to make people possibly much more isolated socially. In some senses, physically isolated. You will have your friends, will be some kind of avatars. You will have your psychologist as an avatar. I don't know what else you will have an avatar. There is, you will have a partner as an avatar. Not difficult to think about all this kind of things. I don't know what it will do to our psyche, but I really am afraid, I fear to think.
What would be the best case scenario?
I think that, you know, we need some kind of ideology which is open-ended in some ways, but really will guide this kind of things. I think that it has to be regulated. You know, people can lose faith in anything. I mean, do you, you know, fake news, for example. I mean, can you believe in anything? I mean, we can very easily, without a lot of regulation, we will slip into some kind of solipsistic existence where the only thing that you know is, you know, your own little world, and you don't trust anything and anybody anymore. And this is, so I don't know, but I think that we are capable of developing and coming to agree. I mean, you know, in my country, for example, at the moment, you see horrible things happening to the society, but also some very remarkable good things happening in the society. I'm talking about Israel. After what Hamas did, I mean, there was a huge shock in Israel, a huge shock, and the complete dysfunctioning of the government. We have a terrible we have a terrible right-wing, fascist, racist government, by the way, and it didn't function. But the civil society did, and people did amazing things, and there was incredible solidarity. This on the one hand. On the other hand, there are elements in our society which are using this opportunity to make life even harder for the Palestinians in the West Bank, for example. And also the cut of obtuseness and blindness to the suffering of the people of Gaza is terrible in Israel. People don't want to know. So you see this combination of, on the one hand, very remarkable acts of solidarity and of kindness and generosity. And on the other hand, you see indifference and cruelty and racism at the same time. And we humans are like that. I mean, these possibilities are within both possibilities. Are there, and we have to channel this in some ways. And it's, I don't know how we do it in this world. I, you know, the older I get, the less I understand.
I typically finish the conversations by asking how has all the research that you've done shaped your outlook on humanity? Now, you already touched upon some of the ways, but is there something you would like to add?
I think that my science, in a way, is my outlook on humanity, too. It's part of my outlook on humanity. I don't think that I can make a real distinction between my life and my work.
Professor Eva Jablonka, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that was it for today. If you enjoyed this, you might also want to check out episodes 17 and 30, which give somewhat different takes on the problem of consciousness. Or if you're interested in the evolution of not consciousness, but conscience, in other words, our ethical sensibilities, you might go to the very, very first episode, episode 1 with Patricia Churston, still one of my favorites. Anyway, I hope that you enjoyed this. If you do, please do consider showing the support of subscribing, giving a nice review, sharing this with a friend, And if you can afford to, show serious support with a small donation monthly at patreon.com/onhumans. Anyway, thank you as always for listening. Until next time, take care.